Wake up, Watson.
Holmes, what time is it?
7:15. A young lady has arrived in a considerable state of excitement. Now, when young ladies wander about the metropolis at this hour of the morning and drag sleepy people up out of their beds, I presume they have something very pressing to communicate.
Just give me a couple of minutes.
Good morning, madam. My name is Sherlock Holmes. This is my friend, Dr. Watson. Draw up to the fire, and I shall order you a cup of hot coffee, for I observe that you are shivering.
It is not cold which makes me shiver.
What, then?
It is fear, gentlemen. It is terror.
You must not fear. We shall soon set matters right. You have come in by train this morning, I see.
Do you know me, then?
No, but I observe the second half of a return ticket in the palm of your left glove. I see that you had a good drive in the dog cart along heavy roads before you reached the station.
Yes, but...
There is no mystery. The left arm of your jacket is spattered with mud in no less than 7 places. The marks are perfectly fresh. Only a dog cart throws up mud in that way.
Mr. Holmes, I can stand this strain no longer. I shall go mad if it continues.
Then pray tell us everything that may help us to form an opinion.
My name is Helen Stoner. I live with my stepfather, Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran.
Roylott? One of the oldest Saxon families in England, and once one of the richest.
All that remains of their wealth is a few acres of ground, and the old house which is crushed under a heavy mortgage. The last squire dragged out his existence there as an aristocratic pauper, but his only son, my stepfather, obtained an advance from a relative, took a medical degree and went out to Calcutta, where he established a large practice.
Yes, Miss Stoner?
In a fit of anger, he... beat his native butler to death and narrowly escaped a capital sentence. As it was, he suffered a long term of imprisonment.
Great heavens.
After his release, he married my mother, the young widow of Major General Stoner.
Of the Bengal Artillery?
Yes. Our mother bequeathed her money to Dr. Roylott entirely while my sister and I resided with him, with a provision that a certain annual sum should be allowed to each of us upon our marriage. Shortly after our return to England, she died in a railway accident. Dr. Roylott abandoned his attempts to establish a practice in London and took us to live with him at Stoke Moran. But then a terrible change came over him.
What kind of a change, precisely?
He became the terror of the village, indulging in ferocious quarrels with whoever might cross his path. Last week, he hurled the local blacksmith over a parapet and into a stream. His only friends are the wandering gypsies. He allows them to camp upon the few acres that remain of the estate. And he has a passion also for Indian animals. He has a cheetah and a baboon wandering freely over the grounds.
Life must be hard for you and your sister.
No servant would stay with us, and for a long time we did all the work of the house. Julie was only 30 when she died, but, like mine, her hair had already begun to turn white.
Your sister is dead, then?
2 years ago, she became engaged to a half-pay major of Marines, whom she had met at our aunt's house near Harrow. Our stepfather offered no objection, but less than a fortnight before the wedding, the terrible event occurred which has deprived me of my only companion.
Pray be precise as to details.
The house is very old, and only one wing is now inhabited. The bedrooms are on the ground floor, all opening out into the same corridor. The first is Dr. Roylott's, the second my sister's, and the third my own. The windows open out upon the lawn. On that night, Dr. Roylott had gone to his room early, and Julia was troubled by the smell of his strong Indian cigars. She came to my room, where we chatted for some time about her approaching wedding. At 11 o'clock she rose to leave, and she paused at the door and asked,
Helen, have you ever heard anyone whistle in the dead of the night?
Never.
You couldn't possibly whistle yourself in your sleep?
Well, certainly not. Why?
During the last few nights, at about 3 a.m, I have been woken by a low, clear whistle. I cannot tell where it came from.
Oh, it must be those wretched gypsies in the plantation.
Perhaps. Yet if it was outside, I wonder that you did not hear it also.
I sleep more heavily than you.
Well, no matter. Good night.
Did you always lock yourselves in at night?
Always. With a cheetah and a baboon at large, we did not feel safe unless our doors were locked.
Quite so. Pray proceed.
I could not sleep. The wind was howling outside, and the rain was beating and splashing against the windows. Suddenly, amid all the hubbub of the gale, I heard a whine. Terrified scream, and I knew that it was my sister's voice. As I opened my door, I seemed to hear a low whistle. And a few moments later, a clanging sound, like a man naked falling. My sister's door swung open. I stared at it, horror-stricken, not knowing what I should see. By the light of the corridor lamp, I saw my sister appear. Her face was blanched with terror. Her hand was groped. Her whole figure swayed to and fro. I ran to her and threw my arms around her. But at that moment, her knees seemed to give way and she fell to the ground. She writhed as if in terrible pain. And as I bent over her, she suddenly shrieked out in a voice which I shall never forget.
Oh, my God! Helen! It was the band! The speckled band!
My stepfather came hastening from his room. Julie was already unconscious, and for all his efforts, she sank and died without having recovered consciousness. Such was the dreadful end of my beloved sister.
Miss Stoner, you have our deepest sympathy.
Are you sure about this whistle and metallic sound? Could you swear to it?
I think so. And yet among the crash of the gale and the creaking of an old house, I may have been mistaken.
Was your sister dressed?
She was in her nightdress. She held the charred stump of a match in one hand and a matchbox in the other.
So she had struck a light and looked about her when the alarm took place. And what conclusions did the coroner reach?
He could not find any satisfactory cause of death. The door had been fastened on the inside, and the windows were securely shuttered. The walls and floor were solid. The chimneys barred up. My sister was alone when she met her end. Besides, there were no marks of violence upon her.
What about poison?
Well, the doctors examined her for it, but without success.
What do you think she died of, then?
I think she died of fear. And what it was that frightened her, I cannot imagine.
And what did you gather from this allusion to a band, a speckled band?
Oh, it may have referred to a band of people. Perhaps the gypsies in the plantation, the spotted handkerchiefs they wear on their heads. Or perhaps it was merely the wild talk of delirium.
These are very deep waters. Pray, go on with your story.
Last month, a dear friend, whom I have known for many years, asked me to marry him. My stepfather has offered no opposition, and we are to be married in the spring.
Ah, felicitations.
2 days ago, some repairs were started in the West Wing, and I have had to move into my sister's room and to sleep in the very bed in which she slept. You can imagine my terror on last night, as I lay thinking over her terrible fate. I suddenly heard that same low whistle. I sprang up and lit the lamp, but nothing was to be seen in the room. I was too shaken to go to bed again. So I dressed, and as soon as it was daylight, I slipped out, got a dog cart, and drove to Leatherhead. My one object was to see you and ask your advice.
But have you told me everything?
Yes, everything.
Miss Stoner, you have not. You are screening your stepfather.
What do you mean? Oh, my arm!
You have been cruelly used.
He is a hard man, and perhaps he hardly knows his own strength.
If we were to come to Stoke Moran today, would it be possible for us to see over these rooms without your stepfather knowing?
Yes. He spoke of coming into town today upon business.
Watson?
You may count on me.
Excellent. What will you do, Miss Stoner?
I shall return by the 12 o'clock train. My heart is lightened already, gentlemen. I look forward to seeing you again this afternoon.
What do you think, Watson?
The most dark and sinister business.
Dark and sinister indeed.
Yet if the floor and walls are sound, and the door, window and chimney are impassable, then her sister must have been alone when she met her death.
But what of these nocturnal whistles? And the very peculiar words of the dying woman?
And the gypsies? What have they to do with it?
I can't imagine. Well, we shall see what awaits us at Stoke Moran.
What in the devil's name?
Which of you is Holmes?
My name, sir, but you have the advantage of me.
I am Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran.
Indeed, Doctor. Pray, take a seat.
I will do nothing of the kind. My stepdaughter has been here. I have traced her. What has she been saying to you?
It is a little cold for the time of year.
What has she been saying to you.
But I have heard that the crocuses promise well.
Ah, you put me off, do you? I know you, you scoundrel. You are Holmes the meddler. Holmes the busybody. Holmes the Scotland Yard jack-it-off.
Your conversation is most entertaining. When you go out, close the door, for there is a decided draught.
I will go when I have had my say. Don't you dare to meddle in my affairs. I'm a dangerous man to fall foul of. See here.
The poker.
See that you keep yourself out of my grip.
He seems a very amiable person. I am not quite so bulky, but if he had remained, I might have shown him that my grip was not much more feeble than his own. There. Straight again. Fancy his having the insolence to confound me with the official detective force.
I hope that our friend will not suffer.
Quite. And now, Watson, we shall order breakfast. Afterwards, I shall walk down to Doctor's Commons, where I hope to get some data which may help us in this matter.
Ah, Holmes.
I have seen the late wife's will. The total income, which was almost £1,100, is now less than £750. Each daughter can claim an income of £250 in case of marriage.
So if both girls had married, this beauty would have had a mere pittance. And even one of them would seriously cripple him.
Indeed. Now, Watson, if you are ready, we shall call a cab and drive to Waterloo. I should be very much obliged if you would slip your revolver into your pocket.
An Ely's number two being an excellent argument with gentlemen who can twist steel pokers into knots.
Precisely. That and a toothbrush are, I think, all we need.
At Leatherhead, we hired a trap and drove for 5 miles through the Surrey lanes. It was a perfect day, with a bright sun.
Look there, beyond the trees. It must be Stoke Moran Manor House.
And there's the village, to our left. If we want to get to the house, we'll find it shorter to cross this stile and follow the footpath over the fields. There, where the lady is walking.
And the lady, I fancy, is Miss Stoner. Yes, I think we'd better do as you suggest. All right, driver, you may stop here.
I've been waiting so eagerly for you. It's all turned out splendidly. Dr. Wilders has gone to town and will not be back before evening.
We have already met your stepfather. He burst into our rooms and tried to persuade us to leave this case well alone.
He is so cunning that I never know when I'm safe from him.
He may find that there is someone more cunning upon his track. You must lock yourself in your room tonight. If he is violent, we shall take you away to your aunt's at Harrow. Now, kindly take us at once to the rooms that we are to examine.
The building was of grey, lichen-blotched stone, with a high central portion and two curving wings like the claws of a crab. On the left, the windows were broken and boarded up, while the roof was partly caved in. The central portion was in little better repair, but the right-hand block was comparatively modern. This was where the family resided. Some scaffolding had been erected against the end wall, and the stonework had been broken into, but there were no signs of any workmen. Holmes carefully examined the windows.
This end room, I take it, is the one in which you used to sleep.
Exactly. But I am now sleeping in the middle one.
Pending the alterations. By the way, there doesn't seem to be any pressing need for repairs.
No.
That is suggestive. Now, these three rooms open onto a corridor. There are windows in it, of course.
A very small ones. Too narrow for anyone to pass through.
And you both locked your doors at night, so your rooms are unapproachable from that side. Now, will you please go into your room and bar your shutters? Those will pass these shutters if they were bolted. Well, we shall see if the inside throws any light upon the matter.
Holmes ignored the room at the end and went at once to the central one. It was a homely little chamber with a low ceiling and a gaping fireplace. A chest of drawers, a narrow bed, a dressing table, and two wicker chairs made up all the furniture, save for a square of carpet in the centre. Holmes sat silently for some minutes while his eyes took in every detail of the room.
Where does that bell pull communicate with?
Oh, it goes to the housekeeper's room.
Is it new?
It was put there a couple of years ago.
Your sister asked for it, I suppose?
No, I never heard of her using it. We always used to get what we wanted ourselves.
It seems unnecessary to put a bell pull just there, with its tassel actually lying upon the pillow. Excuse me for a few minutes while I satisfy myself as to this floor.
Holmes threw himself down upon his face, with his glass in his hand, and crawled swiftly backward and forward, examining minutely the cracks between the boards. Then he did the same with the panelling on the walls. Finally, he walked over to the bed, took the bell rope in his hand and gave it a brisk tug. Why, it's a dummy.
Won't it ring?
No, it's not even attached to a wire. This is very interesting. You can see now that it is fastened to a hook just above that little ventilator.
Oh, how absurd. I never noticed that before.
There are one or two singular points about this room. For example, what a fool a builder must be to open a ventilator into another room, when he might as easily have communicated with the outside air.
Oh, that is also quite modern.
Done about the same time as the bell rope?
Yes. There were several little changes carried out about that time.
Most interesting changes, too. Dummy bell ropes and ventilators that don't ventilate. Now, Miss Stoner, we shall carry our researches into the inner apartment.
Dr. Grimesby Roylott's room was larger, but just as plainly furnished. A camp bed, a small bookshelf, an armchair, a plain wooden chair, a round table, and a large iron safe were the principal things that met the eye.
What is in this safe?
My stepfather's business papers.
You have seen inside, then?
Only once, some years ago. I remember that it was full of papers.
There isn't a cat in it, for example.
No, what a strange idea.
Well, look at this. Why else should there be a saucer of milk on top of the safe?
But we don't keep a cat. There is a cheetah and a baboon.
Well, a cheetah is just a big cat. And yet a saucer of milk does not go very far in satisfying its needs, I dare say. Now, there is one point I should wish to determine, if I may just examine the seat of this chair. Ah, thank you. That is quite settled.
Have you seen all that you need to?
Yes, I think so. Hello, here is something interesting. What do you make of this, Watson?
A small dog lash, curled upon itself and tied so as to make a loop of whipcord. It's a common enough lash, but I don't know why it should be tied.
That is not quite so common, is it? Ah, me. It's a wicked world, and when a clever man turns his brains to crime, it is the worst of all. I think that I have seen enough. Now, Miss Stoner, you must follow my advice in every respect.
I'm in your hands.
In the first place, both my friend and I must spend the night in your room.
Holmes!
Let me explain. I believe that is the village inn over there.
Yes, that is the Crown.
Very good. Your windows will be visible from there.
Certainly.
You must confine yourself to your room on pretense of a headache when your stepfather comes back. Then when you hear him retire for the night, you must open the shutters of your window, undo the hasp, put your lamp there as a signal to us, and then withdraw quietly into the room which you used to occupy. I have no doubt that you can manage in there for one night.
Oh, yes, easily.
The rest you will leave in our hands.
But what will you do?
We shall spend the night in your room and investigate the cause of this disturbance.
I believe, Mr. Holmes, that you have already made up your mind.
Perhaps I have.
Then for pity's sake, tell me what was the cause of my sister's death.
I should prefer to have clearer proof before I speak.
Well, you can at least tell me whether my suspicions are correct. Did she die from some sudden fright?
No. I think there was probably some more tangible cause. And now, Miss Stoner, we must leave you. If Dr. Roylott returned and saw us, our journey would be in vain. Goodbye, and be brave. If you do as I have told you, we shall soon drive away the dangers that threaten you.
At dusk, from our window on the upper floor of the Crown, we saw Dr. Roylott drive past, his huge form looming up beside the little figure of the lad who drove him. The boy had some slight difficulty in undoing the heavy iron gates, and we heard the hoarse roar of the doctor's voice and saw the fury with which he shook his clenched fists at him. The trap drove on, and a few minutes later, a light sprang up among the trees as a lamp was lit in one of the sitting rooms.
You know, Watson, I really have some reluctance to taking you tonight. There is a distinct element of danger.
You have evidently seen more in those rooms than I have.
No, but I fancy that I may have deduced a little more.
I saw nothing remarkable, save the bell rope.
And the ventilator.
Yes, but a small opening between rooms isn't so unusual, and it's not big enough to let a rat through.
I knew that we should find a ventilator before we ever came to Stoke Moran.
My dear Holmes.
Yes, I did. Miss Stoner said that her sister could smell Dr. Roylott's cigar, do you remember?
Ah, of course. But what harm can there be in that?
Well, there is at least a curious coincidence of dates. A ventilator is made, a cord is hung, and a lady who sleeps in the bed dies. Did you observe anything peculiar about that bed?
No.
It was cramped to the floor. It must always be in the same relative position to the ventilator and the rope.
Holmes, we are only just in time to prevent some subtle and horrible crime.
Just so. When a doctor goes wrong, he is the worst of criminals. He has nerve, and he has knowledge. Well, we shall have horrors enough before the night is over. Let us have a quiet pipe and turn our minds for a few hours to something more cheerful.
At about 9 o'clock, the light among the trees was extinguished, and all was dark in the direction of the manor house. 2 hours passed slowly, and then suddenly, just at the stroke of 11.
There is our signal, Watson. It is time to make our move.
A moment later, we were out on the dark road, the chill wind blowing in our faces. Making our way across the trees, we reached the lawn, crossed it, and were about to enter through the window, when out from a clump of laurel bushes there darted what seemed to be a hideous and distorted child. It threw itself upon the grass, with writhing limbs, and then ran swiftly across the lawn into the darkness.
A nice household. That is the baboon.
Inside the bedroom, my companion noiselessly closed the shutters, moved the lamp onto the table, and cast his eyes around the room. All was as it had been in the daytime.
The least sound would be fatal to our plans. We must sit without light. You would see it through the ventilator.
I understand.
Do not go to sleep. Your very life may depend upon it. Have your pistol ready. I will sit on the side of the bed and you in that chair.
I laid my revolver on the table, and Holmes placed his long thin cane upon the bed beside him. By it he laid the box of matches and the stump of a candle. Then he turned down the lamp, and we were left in absolute darkness. From outside came the occasional cry of a night bird, and once, at our very window, a long-drawn cat-like whine, which told us that the cheetah was nearby. 12 struck, and 1, and 2, and 3. And still we sat waiting silently for whatever might befall. Suddenly, there was the momentary gleam of a light up in the direction of the ventilator. It vanished immediately, but was succeeded by a smell of burning oil and heated metal. Someone in the next room had lit a dark lantern. I heard a gentle sound of movement, and then all was silent once more, though the smell grew stronger. For half an hour I sat with straining ears. Then suddenly another sound became audible, a very gentle, soothing sound, like that of a small jet of steam escaping continually from a kettle. Holmes instantly sprang from the bed, struck a match, and lashed furiously with his cane at the bell pull.
You see it, Watson, you see it!
But I saw nothing, save that my friend's face was deadly pale and filled with horror and loathing. He had ceased to strike and was gazing up at the ventilator when suddenly there broke from the silence of the night...
Watson, it is all over. And perhaps, after all, it is for the best. Take your pistol and we'll enter Dr. Roylott's room.
It was a terrible sight that met our eyes. On the table stood a dark lantern with the shutter half open, throwing a beam of light upon the iron safe, the door of which was ajar. Dr. Grimesby Roylott sat motionless on the wooden chair, clad in a long grey dressing gown, his bare ankles protruding beneath, and his feet thrust into red Turkish slippers. Across his lap lay the dog lash. His chin was cocked upwards, and his eyes were fixed in a dreadful, rigid stare at the corner of the ceiling. Round his brow, he had a peculiar yellow band with brownish speckles, which seemed to be bound tightly round his head.
The band? The speckled band?
Good God!
It was Sonar, the deadliest snake in India. He has died within 10 seconds of being bitten. Violence does, in truth, recoil upon the violent, and the schemer falls into the pit that he digs for another. Let us thrust this creature back into its den.
He drew the dog whip swiftly from the dead man's lap, and throwing the noose round the reptile's neck, he drew it from its horrid perch, and carrying it at arm's length, threw it into the iron safe, which he closed upon it. Such are the true facts of the death of Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran. We conveyed Miss Stoner by the morning train to the care of her aunt in Harrow. The official inquiry came to the conclusion that the doctor met his fate while indiscreetly playing with a dangerous pet. The little that I had yet to learn of the case was told to me by Sherlock Holmes as we travelled back the next day.
The discovery that the bell rope was a dummy and that the bed was clamped from the floor instantly suggested that the rope was there as a bridge or something passing through the ventilator and coming to the bed. The idea of a snake occurred to me, and knowing that the doctor was furnished with a supply of creatures from India, I felt that I was probably on the right track. It was a form of poison which could not be discovered by any chemical test. West. Just such a notion as would occur to a clever and ruthless man with an eastern training.
A quick-acting poison, too. That would be an advantage.
It would be a sharp-eyed coroner who could spot two little punctures where the fangs had done their work. Then I thought of the whistle. Of course, he must recall the snake before it could be seen in the morning light. He had trained it, probably by use of the milk, to return to him when summoned. He would put it through the ventilator with the certainty that it would fall down the rope and land on the bed. It might or might not bite the occupant. She might escape every nightfall, but sooner or later she must fall a victim. Roylott had been in the habit of standing on his chair, obviously, in order to reach the ventilator. The sight of the safe, the saucer of milk, and the loop of whipcord were enough to dispel any doubts which remained.
And the metallic clang heard by Miss Stoner was caused by her stepfather closing the door of his safe upon its terrible occupant.
Indeed. Well, you know what steps I took to prove the facts of the matter. I heard the creature hiss, as you did yourself, and I quickly lit the light and attacked it.
With the result of driving it back through the ventilator and causing it to turn upon its master, waiting on the other side.
Flew upon the first person I saw. No doubt I am indirectly responsible for the death of Dr. Grimesby Roylott. But I cannot say that it is likely to weigh very heavily on my conscience.
Listening to The Speckled Band by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized for radio by Chris Drake. You heard Jim Crozier as Sherlock Holmes and Dave Hawkes as Dr. Watson, with Angie Bart as Helen Stoner, Sarah Bell as Julia Stoner, and Brian Adrian as Dr. Grimesby Roylott. The announcer was Angie Bart. The play was directed by Roger Johnson and produced by Dennis Rookard for Hossyprog Productions.